Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You can't really do an effective parody of conspiracism because it gets immediately co-opted into the paranoid style and the conspiracist frame of mind. There's nothing that cannot be believed.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines. Here are your hosts, Matthew Galt and Jason Fields.
Hello and welcome to War College. I am Matthew Galt.
And I'm Jason Fields.
We're back with another episode of the War College Annex. These are those bonus episodes that go off the beaten path. And again, we're talking about QAnon, the popular internet-driven conspiracy theory that supposes President Trump is at war with an ancient and powerful pedophile cult. When QAnon believers began showing up at Trump rallies, the media took notice, and in early August, BuzzFeed published a report supposing that Q was an elaborate left-wing prank on believers. The evidence? A book published in Italy in the 1990s titled Q. With us today is Wu Ming Wan, one of the authors of that book. He's here to help us disentangle QAnon from the novel, talk about the importance of conspiracy theories to culture, and what makes a good cultural prank, and how you can use pranks to debunk conspiracy theories. Wu Ming Wan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So my first question is, are you responsible for QAnon?
Of course not.
All right, well, let's... Can you explain the plot of the book and why people might think that you are?
Okay. The novel Q was published for the first time in springtime of 1999 in Italy, the Italian edition. Then it was translated into 18 languages and published in 30 countries, including the U.S. Of course, on that side of the Atlantic, the book was far less successful than in Europe. It became kind of a cult novel in some niches, but it was never as famous as it was in Italy and several other European countries. It was published in 2004 in the US. The novel Q was the final contribution that I and three other co-authors gave to the so-called Luther Bliss Project, which was a project of cultural agitation and communication guerrilla that lasted from 1994 to 1999. I think we can talk about that later on. Now I'll focus on the novel. The novel is set in the 16th century on the backdrop of the radical uprisings that followed Martin Luther's Reformation. And especially the first part is focused on the Peasants' War, which was a huge peasant insurrection in Germany led by a guy named Thomas Münzer, which means Thomas the Coiner. And then the plot moves to other attempts at, you know, at revolution in the course of that century. It was a very turbulent century back then, with a lot of religious wars and a lot of heresies springing out like mushrooms, okay? And we follow the main character. The main character has no name. He changes name every time he changes town. Chapter by chapter, he adopts several names and new identities. We never really get to know his real name. He's a radical and a Baptist revolutionary. A former student of theology at Wittenberg, which is the same town in which Martin Luther wrote his famous theses, and he nailed them on the door, you know, of the cathedral, of Wittenberg Cathedral. Well, this guy is followed at a distance by another guy who's the villain in our novel. This guy is an agent provocateur. He's a spy, a secret agent. He works for the Pope, for the Vatican. And he sends letters to Thomas Münzer and other radical leaders, deliberately spreading false information, you know, fake news, in order to make the peasant army fall into a trap. So he keeps sending this letter, posing as a fellow radical. He says that he writes from kind of, you know, top levels of power in a way. He claims to be an infiltrator, but of course he's double crossing them. He's doing a double game. And he keeps sending these letters, which are signed Kohelet, which in Hebrew means a preacher. Of course, it's a book of the Bible, you know, Kohelet. At the same time, he keeps sending reports of his own activities to his boss. His boss is Giovanni Pietro Carafa, cardinal, later to become a pope himself, Paul IV, okay, the guy who renewed Inquisition in the 1540s. These dispatches are signed Q, simply as Q. And he reports about his misleading activities. He's spreading, you know, urban legends and false pieces of information and stuff like that. He is the main cause in our novel, not in actual history, but in our novel, he is the main cause of the peasant army's defeat in Frankenhausen. In 1525, the whole revolutionary army led by Thomas Münzer marched towards this city in Thuringia called Frankenhausen, in which they had a field battle. They thought it would be the final, definitive battle for victory, and they were confronted by a huge reactionary army hired by the princes and the bishops. It was a crushing defeat. They were not only defeated, but practically exterminated. So it was the end for that early example of modern class revolution. Then our character moves to this other town called Münster, in which revolutionaries take over and kind of start a commune, like the Paris Commune in 1871. But this guy Q is a infiltrates this struggle too, and he keeps spreading false information until they defeat. It's like that all the time until the end of the novel.
So people in this country find this book relevant because, is it because they think that it's an allegory, or do they think that it's a conspiracy that started then and is still going on today?
The book was an allegory of our own activities, the activities of the Luther Blissett Project in the second half of the 90s in Italy and other countries of continental Europe, and also a little bit in the UK. We conceived it, we constructed it as an allegory. It's about, psychological warfare. It's about techniques of communication guerrilla. It's about pulling pranks. And on a level, there are other levels of interpretation, of course, but that was the one that caused a sensation in those days when it was published in Italy. Then it became kind of night table book, Livre de Chevet, as they say in French, for a new generation of activists, the generation that after the so-called Battle of Seattle at the end of 1999 started to, you know, confront neoliberal globalization, and they started to protest at big summits, big meetings of WTO, the World Bank, the G8, like in Genoa in 2001. That generation of activists took Q as a whole set of references. People used to call themselves with the names of the characters of the novel and stuff like that. So it was a bestseller. It's a long seller. This side of the Atlantic, not the other side of the Atlantic, in which is less known.
All right, well, let's zoom out a little bit, and let's start, because I want to dig into the project that kind of gave rise to the book, and this idea of, I guess, conspiracy theories or cultural pranks for good that are kind of righteous. But first, can you explain to us what the paranoid style is? I think that's a really important concept to grasp here.
Okay, the paranoid style is what defines a conspiracy theory. It's a rhetoric, it's a frame of mind. It was defined for the first time by a political scientist, an American political scientist, Richard Hofstadter, back in 1964. He wrote a seminal essay, a very important essay, called The Paranoid Style in American Politics, in which he dealt mainly with the kind of conspiracies that the John Birch Society used to talk about at that time. Okay, but he traced the origins of the paranoid style, at least in the US, back in the 1830s. And for example, he demonstrated that such important figures like Samuel B. Morse, the inventor of the telegraph and the Morse code, indulged very much in anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and stuff like that. Okay, so the paranoid style is a useful concept because it can help us make the correct distinction between actual conspiracies, okay, and conspiracism. Okay, because we shouldn't make the mistake of saying that conspiracies don't exist, because of course some conspiracies do exist. What is a conspiracy? You have a conspiracy when a group of people, or more than one people, agree in secret to take some action against someone else, a third party, against someone else's interests, at least. Okay, so there are some requirements, some characteristics. There must be more than one person, otherwise it's not a conspiracy, of course. The agreement between those persons must be secret, because if you do things in broad daylight, that's not a conspiracy. Everyone can see what you're doing. And the most important characteristic, at least according to me, action must be against someone. The example that I usually make is, if you organize a surprise party for your dad's birthday, that's not a conspiracy. Because you are agreeing in secret with other people, but not against someone else, because you're not conspiring against your dad by organizing a surprise party. It must be a very awful party in order to have that characteristic. Okay, so you can say that conspiracies do exist, but real, actual conspiracies have some key characteristics that make them very different from the kind of convoluted, cumbersome conspiracy theories which conspiracists dream about and share and spread. Okay.
Well, give us an example of a real life conspiracy, like one that was actually true.
Watergate. I held a lecture here. I'm in Montreal right now. I held a lecture yesterday about these issues, and they made the example of Watergate. Okay, Watergate was an actual conspiracy. There were some aides and collaborators and lackeys of Richard Nixon who effectively agreed in secret in order to take some action against the people whom they perceived as Nixon's enemies. Of course, that's why those burglars were wiretapping the Watergate Hotel that night, okay? And they were caught in the act. The fact that they were caught in the act is very interesting, okay? Because that gives us the opportunity to focus on the, I don't know if the English term is correct, the imperfectness of actual conspiracies. They are not perfect. Okay, so usually real conspiracies have a very specific aim, okay, a precise focus. In that case, the focus was on Nixon's enemies, and there was a set of limited practices which those people used to call rat fucking. Okay, it was a way of sabotage the activities of democratic leaders and people whom they perceived as Nixon's enemies. Real conspiracy, second characteristic. Real conspiracies usually involve a limited number of actors. In that case, there were five or six important people belonging to Richard Nixon's team, and then there were some other lackeys and agents, but the number of people taking part in the Watergate conspiracy always remained very limited. Okay, the people who went on trial later on. Okay, the other one is actual conspiracies usually have a somewhat shaky development. They're not as coherent as the imaginary conspiracies, okay? And the fact that those burglars were caught in flagrante, okay, is a demonstration that these people acted in a very clumsy way, actually, okay? So you have a shaky development and a narrative of the conspiracies that's not that paranoically coherent, okay? And it's usually very easy to sum up. The narrative of an actual conspiracy is usually very easy to summarize, okay? I just did that in the case of Watergate. The other thing is that actual conspiracy usually don't last long before they are discovered and exposed. In that case, it lasted a few years, okay? And it was discovered, people found out about it, and there was an investigation, a journalistic inquiry, Woodward and Bernstein, and the conspiracy was exposed a few years after it had started. And the most important one, the fifth one, at least to my advice, is that once a real conspiracy is exposed, it's over. The end. Over. Its effects may persist, but operations stop. They cease. Okay. On the contrary, the kind of conspiracy that's imagined and built up and talked about by conspiracy theorists, it's exactly the opposite. Usually, an alleged conspiracy has the widest possible scope, not a specific purpose, but the widest one, because usually this kind of conspiracy allegedly aims at ruling or conquering or destroying the planet, the whole world. Okay. The second characteristic is that this kind of conspiracy, of alleged conspiracy, involves a huge and potentially unlimited number of actors. And this number seems to increase and increase and increase at every account, because anyone who denies the existence of the conspiracy is immediately denounced as part of it. So the number keeps increasing, increasing, increasing. And at the end, there are multitudes, of people allegedly being part of the conspiracy. We saw this with Pizzagate, we saw this with QAnon as well. Okay. And this is contrary to Occam's razor. Occam's razor said, non sunt multiplicanda entia sine necessitate, which means keep things easy, keep things easy to explain. Don't multiply factors, don't add useless complexity to your description of reality. Okay. The other one is that the alleged conspiracy usually is carried out in an extremely coherent, ultra-consistent way, because in the narrative of that kind of conspiracy, things always go exactly as planned. Everything confirms the narrative, every detail fits perfectly in. Okay, every piece of the jigsaw puzzle fits perfectly. So ultra coherent. The fourth one is that this kind of conspiracy is eternal. It goes on indefinitely. Some of these conspiracies are described as being going on for decades, and other ones even for centuries or millennia. Okay, and fifth one, this kind of conspiracy allegedly keeps going on, it goes on, in spite of the existence of hundreds of books and articles and websites and videos and podcasts allegedly exposing it. Even if it's exposed, it keeps going on. Okay, so it's exactly the opposite of an actual conspiracy like Watergate. Each one of these five characteristics is exactly the opposite of the previous set of characteristics.
And you've designed some conspiracies yourself, correct? Or you've been a part of it?
We practically debunked some conspiracies. We devised pranks as a practical critique and a direct intervention against conspiracies. That's what we did with the Luther Blissett Project, with some of our extremely elaborate media pranks, you know, because we pulled some very complex pranks, kind of LARPs, because they were so complex that they required the assistance and the collaboration and the imagination of dozens of people all across the country, all across Italy. We pulled those kind of pranks, for example, in the middle to late 90s in order to show how dangerous the great pedophilia / satanic ritual abuse scare was, okay, because there was mass paranoia about Satanists and pedophiles back in those days. It was the same wave of moral panic that had invested the U.S. in the 80s, you know, after that book Michelle Remembers, there was this satanic ritual abuse scare, child abuse scare, that kind of stuff. That same wave invested Europe a few years later, okay, especially after this serial killer, this guy Marc Dutroux, the monster of Marcinelle in Belgium, was arrested, and it was discovered that he had tortured and killed a lot of kids, etc. After that, there was a huge wave of moral panic, and several innocent people were victims of that climate, you know, of that atmosphere, extremely paranoid atmosphere, and they were arrested with horrible charges, sent to prison in solitary confinement on a basis that was the basis of conspiracism, okay? Because there was this vision of secret dungeons, secret tunnels, where ritual child abuse was taking place with the cooperation of several people, secret operators, even politicians, and stuff like that. Okay, so we devised some pranks as part of our counter investigations and sometimes solidarity campaigns to show that some defendants in important trials that were accused of satanic ritual abuse were actually innocent. And in fact, they were all acquitted. They were all acquitted. And the money even gave them, and the state even gave them money as a compensation for their unjust imprisonment. Okay, so we devised some pranks that aimed at showing that it was all bullshit. Okay, for example, the most complex one was played by really dozens of people in near Rome, in a town near Rome called Viterbo, in the backwoods around the town. That prank lasted a year. We simulated the existence of a satanic sect of black masses taking place in the woods, and even we faked the existence of a group of Christian anti-Satanist vigilantes looking for Satanists in order to beat them up, to disrupt their rituals and stuff like that. It was all made up, okay? There were neither Satanists nor vigilantes, no black mass, no ritual abuse, nothing like that. There were only fake pictures, uncanny objects which we left in the woods, and especially some particularly crazy communique, you know, press releases, which we sent to the local and national media, and they were signed by this group called the COSAMO, Committee for the Safeguard of Morals. It was this group of anti-Satanist vigilantes. And the media, the local press at the beginning, and then also the national media, they believed everything. They published everything with no fact checking at all, because we were in the middle of a moral panic wave, and everyone was talking about ritual abuse and pedophilia and Satanists. So also politicians at a certain point jumped on the bandwagon of mass paranoia, and the tipping point was when we managed to get footage of a fake satanic ritual broadcast in the national TV news, in primetime TV news on a national level. It was a very clumsy and blurred video. You didn't see anything, actually. It was all, you know, in the shadow, with people with hoods on and candles and stuff like that. And they broadcast it and commented upon it. At the end, we claimed the responsibility for the whole thing after a whole year. It lasted a whole year. We claimed the responsibility and produced a huge mass of evidence proving that we were responsible for that, and Satanists and vigilantes had actually never existed. We caused quite a sensation. But also the Luther Blissett Project was responsible for a huge counter inquiry on cases of false accusations of on child abuse.
Let me ask you a question, though. So once you revealed that you were behind the prank, do you think that there were people who continued to believe it anyway? I mean, is that a concern?
No, not in that case. Not in that case, because we had a reputation. Okay, we already had a reputation. We had been pulling pranks like that, maybe not that complex all the time, for years. Okay, so because our project started in 1994. This prank, this pseudo-satanic prank, was in 1998. So for 40 years, we had been pulling pranks, okay, organizing pranks, and the name Luther Blissett was associated with this kind of activities. The purpose of the whole Luther Blissett project thing was to adopt the same moniker, the same pseudonym, and the same name altogether. Hundreds of people, hundreds of artists and activists, cultural agitators, adopted the same name and used it in order to, you know, sign their, you know, works of art or writings or performances, or claiming responsibility for pranks. So Luther Blissett was famous, kind of a Robin Hood of a digital age, a social bandit, a prankster. Every action added to the reputation of this imaginary guy, who was a collective entity, actually. So when we claimed responsibility for that, everyone believed it, because we already had a track, we had a reputation.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
This reminds me of Houdini or James Randi. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Who are both magicians that would debunk spiritualism by showing you how you did the trick and then explaining the trick to you.
Yeah, yeah, there are some similarities. Yeah, many similarities. We were always being very much interested in magic. It was about claiming responsibility by explaining in detail what kind of tricks we had used and what kind of bugs in the information system we had taken advantage of in order to pull the prank. So it had an educational aspect, kind of, because how can I say, we focused on cultural automatisms and then said it, and then told we usually told people, you acted following a cultural automatism. You are in the middle of a, you know, a moral panic wave, so you instantly believed that kind of bullshit, because everyone's talking about that kind of bullshit by claiming that it's real. We proved that we faked it. Okay, for one that we fake it, how many more are fake and are faked by the media or are automatically generated by a cultural automatism? You know, because there's no conspiracy behind this kind of stuff. Nobody decides that there will be a wave of moral panic about a particularly sensitive issue. Nobody decides that. That's no conspiracy on that level. Of course, there's culture. Culture has some mechanisms and some it undergoes many phases. You know, things happen. Okay, so we always explained the kind of, you know, flaws in the media system we had exploited in order to pull the prank. And it was kind of an educational DIY aspect. Okay, you can do that too if you organize. You can do that too. Okay, you don't have to be a passive consumer of the media. Okay, you can counteract, okay, in cases like this. So our pranks had the three important aspects. You know, the content that we choose to put into them, because these pranks were always pulled in order to raise awareness on some sensitive issues, and especially on how the media talked about those sensitive issues. Okay, so the content was never produced at random. You know, it was very deliberate. Okay, we had meetings and we decided what to do. And then there was this do-it-yourself aspect and this kind of reverse engineering aspect, explaining what we had done. And the account of how we did the prank was always more important than the prank itself. Okay, and then there was this aspect of which I would call communitarian, because each prank added to Luther Blissett's reputation and made calling yourself Luther Blissett ever more appealing.
So you have to build a myth first.
Yeah, exactly. And you were part of that myth. You were not a passive contemplator, a passive consumer of that myth. You were part of it in an active way, in an engaging way, and you felt being part of a warm community of people sharing the same purpose. Okay, you shared a certain style, a certain imagery, even if you never met the other members in person. Okay, because there were cases in which some people gave important contribution without ever meeting in person. For example, we had regular meetings in which we met in Bologna. We were 50 people. Also in Rome, there was a huge group. Okay, but there were other individual contributors to the Luther Blissett project that were, you know, scattered apart in the whole country or even in other countries, sometimes communicating with each other via the mail art network. No, because the Luther Blissett project came out of the kind of, there were some underground currents in culture, you know, in the 80s, and of small pieces of art and zines sent via the snail mail, via the surface mail. And it was a huge network predating the internet, and some people communicated with each other about Luther Blissett via the mail art network. Okay, so there were three aspects: the content, the DIY aspect, and community. That was the most important thing. But it's revealing. It's very interesting that you talked about Randy. and Houdini, because we strictly collaborate with magicians. You know, there's this guy who's part of the Wu Ming Foundation called Mariano Tomatis, who is a magician, a historian of illusions. He focuses his work on exploring ways of revealing the trick behind the magic act in a way which doesn't spoil the magic act, but makes it even more magic. There are some examples of that. Yesterday I showed a video with Penn and Teller. You know, I think Penn and Teller are the best illusionists in the world. There are some magic acts in which they show the exact tricks that they just used. First they perform the act and people are in awe. They look at them and say, wow. And then they repeat the act, for example, with transparent props. So you can see all the secret moves that they're doing. You understand that you've been misdirected the first time. And you see that there's a lot of work behind a magic act. Seeing that, you're even more in awe than before. And you go, wow, wow, because there's a way of revealing a trick that makes magic even more magic. And that's what we did with our pranks.
Well, so let me ask, do you think that kind of prank is what's happening in the United States? Is that behind any of these really outlandish conspiracy theories? Or do you think that the conspiracy theories we have now are just organic?
Yeah, I think they're just organic. There's something in American culture, Western culture, not only in American culture, which keeps creating conspiracy theories. There are some key elements that keep resurfacing. For example, this thing of child abuse and secret dungeons. It faded out at the end of the 80s or in the early 90s in the US, and then resurfaced with Pizzagate in 2016. Then Pizzagate seemed to paid out, but it became Pedogate for a while, and then took the definitive shape of Q and on. But there's always the thing of secret rings, of pedophiles, of dungeons. I mean, Comet Ping Pong in Washington, D.C. didn't even have a dungeon. Didn't even have a basement, but people kept saying that there was a basement in which ritual child abuse took place with the complicity of top Democratic officials and leaders and stuff like that. Okay. So there are some archetypes that keep resurfacing.
Do you think your kind of myth-busting techniques would be effective now, or is the world too different? Is the media cycle too different?
Mutatis mutandis, as they say in Latin, we change in the necessary things to change. Well, I think we're still exploring that kind of stuff. Even we don't pull prank anymore, but we keep exploring that way of, we called it showing the stitches, like the stitchings on the body of the Frankenstein monster. Okay, you see the stitches, so you understand that he's composed of multiple parts of multiple cadavers. Okay, even in our fiction, in our way of telling stories, of writing novels, or even writing nonfiction, we keep the factory open. We show our tools. We always explain the kind of techniques that we use. Because we're still looking for that particular way of revealing tricks that doesn't spoil magic. Okay, so that's what we keep thinking. When we tweeted about QAnon for the first time, okay, a lot of people were interested, including you, Matthew, and we received several requests of interviews from several countries, not only the US, also Germany, France, and Italy. Okay. What we did in that particular case was, okay, seeding doubt about the origins of QAnon, always saying we're not sure it started as a prank. If it started as a prank, it was a miscalculated one. If it started as a parody, they didn't take into account what Umberto Eco showed in his masterpiece Foucault's Pendulum, that you can't really do an effective parody of conspiracism because it gets immediately co-opted into the paranoid style and the conspiracist frame of mind. There's nothing that cannot be believed. There's nothing that's too much. Okay, so you do a parody, you do a satire, and you will find people who actually believe it. Okay, so if it started as parody, it was doomed to be completely ineffective. If it started as a prank, you know, people either from the left or even from the most, irreverent currents of the alt-right, you know, started as a prank in order to troll the gullible rightists who would believe that kind of bullshit, it immediately got out of hand and took a life of its own. So we, in a way, started to seed doubt, but in a rational way. But what we also did was revive the spirit of our old pranks. I mean, because we think that popping the conspiracy balloon is absolutely ineffective. A debunking that's only rational, you know, with rational arguments, falls flat. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. That's what we, in Italian, we call it debunking ratio suprematista, ratio supremacist, which is because it establishes a supremacy of reason, you know, with a sound argument and with facts, unassailable facts. You can debunk a conspiracy. It doesn't work like that because conspiracy theories operate on the level of myths, okay, which is completely unassailable by reason alone. You have to do something else. So what we did in that case was to inoculate into the debate on QAnon the word prank. After that, as you noticed, the frame in which QAnon was discussed was slightly rearranged, and there was some sense of bafflement that spread in some rightist milieu, okay, because the word prank was enough to, you know, to raise suspicion. But we also did, we weren't sure about that, but the most important thing is that we made the examples of our work, our 90s work. So we tried to inoculate some sense of wonder, something that was fun, because the problem is that debunking is not fun, while conspiracies is. People who are into conspiracies enjoy that dimension very much, okay? Because conspiracism and the paranoid style, in a way, in a very warped way, encounter some basic needs that we as humans have, okay? Conspiracists play in the same league as psychics, astrologers, sorcerers, magicians, healers.
It puts a little bit of magic and excitement back into the world for people.
Exactly. That's precisely that. It's precisely that, okay? Because we do need a sense of wonder in our lives. We do need difference, different angles from which looking at things. We need that, okay? And they provide it, while rational debunking doesn't provide it. If you could do debunking of conspiracies while retaining the same sense of wonder which conspiracists exploit, that would be great. It's the right thing to do. That's why we focus the attention on those illusionists who explain the tricks, because they are kind of debunking themselves, but retaining the sense of wonder. And the other thing that's important is that every conspiracy theory, even the craziest one, has a kernel of truth. And if you don't talk about that kernel of truth, you reinforce the belief in the conspiracy theory. We made a lot of examples in the past few weeks, and also in my lecture yesterday at McGill University. For example, I did the example of chemtrails. You know, chemtrails are a distorted version of a legitimate preoccupation for climate change. Okay, the system cannot deny itself. Okay, it always bends every feeling and emotion, tries to bend every feeling and emotion and anxiety and preoccupation towards we call it diversionary narrative. A narrative that's more or less about the same issue, but doesn't address its core. Okay, so the chemtrails conspiracy theory was born because of that, because you have people, okay, that see the signs of climate change every day, but they are surrounded by people who deny it or acknowledge it, but don't do anything relevant to stop it. Okay, so there's kind of cognitive dissonance, because people think, but if the situation is so bad, why the people in power don't do anything about it? How can the situation be so bad if everyone goes on with their habits, with the same things every day, like as though life could go on forever like this? But there are images of doom on the TV. There are hurricanes, gigantic fires devastating Southern California woods. You have floods, you have droughts, you have at the White House, there's a guy, there's a climate change negationist. He denies even the existence of the phenomenon, and even the politicians who acknowledge the phenomenon don't do anything about it, okay? Because of the Paris protocols is a farce. Of course, nobody's doing nothing, okay? So these people have to cope with this cognitive dissonance, and a diversionary narrative is produced, is automatically generated. And even the symptom is correct, because the increase in air traffic with low-cost flights, etc., it's true that you see more chemtrails.
Contrails. The real thing is a contrail. Condensation trail is what it's short for. I just want to stick that in there.
But they do call them chemtrails. The conspiracists do.
I just wanted to get the real thing there.
It's a chemical process anyway. It's not the chemical process they think it is. Okay, but it's true that the increase in air traffic is also increasing air pollution and stuff like that. So the symptom is more or less correct. But the problem is the diversionary narrative that takes people away from the kernel of truth of their conspiracy and prevents them from correctly addressing the issue. Okay, and the real issue behind all this is climate change. Okay, so every conspiracy has a kernel of truth. Even 9/11 truthers have a conspiracy that has a kernel of truth, but is perverted into a diversionary narrative.
Well, let me ask you this then. What is the kernel of truth at the center of QAnon?
The kernel of truth of QAnon is that people are insecure about who's in power, is that there are all these, state agencies, intelligence agencies that you don't really know what they do. There was some times ago, there was all the NSA controversy about, the government spying on citizens all the time. So there were all the WikiLeaks controversy. There was Snowden fleeing from the country and taking refuge in Russia. So people heard about that in a confused way. So you don't really know what those guys are doing at the Pentagon, at the NSA, at the CIA, and stuff like that. Of course, they're not having child sex, okay? It's not about pedophilia, nothing like that. And that's also another important kernel of truth. I'm not the first one to notice it and focus on it. There's another cognitive dissonance here, and this is the gap between the utopian kind of utopian expectations which Donald Trump fans had about his presidency and the grim reality, boring also for them, reality of his presidency, because he isn't doing anything for the white working class or stuff like that. So I have to cope with this and kind of feel the gap between what they thought he would do and what he's doing. And so the result is you think he isn't doing anything, okay, from their point of view, of course. You think he isn't doing that, but in secret, he's fighting against an evil cabal of pedophiles running the world, and he's a genius, and he's playing a multidimensional chess game, all in secret, because you don't see anything about that, of course. So there's a cognitive dissonance. There's a kind of fantasy that was created in order to overcome disillusionment and disappointment about the Trump presidency, because also them are disappointed by this presidency, because it's no right-wing utopia as they thought.
Wu Ming Wan, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking us through all of that.
Thank you very much for having me. It was fun.
That's this week's episode, dear listeners. Thank you so much for joining us. Recording this outro during a thunderstorm, which feels appropriately spooky given the subject matter. We ran into some technical difficulties in the past 2 weeks here at War College, and I wanted to apologize for that. We'd originally planned to run 2 episodes this week, but we only had time to run one. It was the bonus that we'd recorded first. Everything is straightened out now, though, and in the coming weeks, we'll be talking about what makes a good comic book war memoir, delve into a little ancient Greek history. War College is me, Matthew Galt, and Jason Fields. You can find War College online at warcollegepodcast.com, facebook.com/warcollege, and on Twitter @war_college. If you like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps others find the show, and Jason just might read your review on the air. Until next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.